Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to this special edition of the Roundtable. First, I also want to thank all of you who were here last week for TMR's 50th anniversary celebration to benefit the Levi L. Smith Scholarship Fund. The numbers aren't all in yet, but it was great. There were almost 200 people who registered. I thought we had a great conversation with Charles Blow, George Kilpatrick, and we got to meet some of our past scholarship recipients. So I really appreciate that. Thank you. If you were here, you also know that we had a great little video clip with interviews from some of the TMR members who have been the longest attending. You notice how I'm careful not to say they're the oldest TMR members. They're not. But who have been attending the longest in TMR's 50-year history. And Marilyn Pinsky was one of those people. Actually, she's the one woman who still attends regularly, who was a member way back when, not 50 years ago, but a while ago. So that was great. So I really appreciated when Marilyn came to me and asked if she could hold this lecture, the Philip Pinsky Memorial Lecture at TMR in conjunction with TMR. So we're happy to do that today. So I looked back to see when today's speaker, I knew he had spoken at the roundtable, certainly even in my time. He's been on a couple of panels. But in looking back at history again, we're doing the Wayback Machine. The first one I saw was in April of 1981. Jim Introne, who was the New York State Commissioner of Mental Retardation and Developmental Disabilities, spoke on the development of a comprehensive service system for the mentally retarded, 1975 to the present. That might have been one of the longest titles of any TMR program. So that's our first record of having Jim Introne speak. And so we're really anxious and happy that he's here with us today. And to introduce him, again, another bit of history. Although the first women were inducted into the roundtable in 1968, the first woman to speak at the roundtable was in 1969. And that was Mrs. Alexander Holstein, Jr., as she was known on the program, who was a member of the New York State Board of Social Welfare and spoke on New Horizons in Social Services. But today, Chucky Holstein is going to introduce our guest speaker. Thank you, Chucky.
It's nice to see so many familiar faces. I think I've worked with almost everybody in the room in some capacity or other way back. But I'm really honored to introduce Jim Introne today. But I first want to talk about two people who really impacted on the delivery of healthcare as we know it today. And that's Philip Pinsky and Jim Introne. Phil and Jim met when both of them worked at the Willowbrook Court Consent Decree in 1970. And for those of you who are old enough to remember, like I do, Willowbrook was gravely in need of improving conditions for the children with mental disabilities who lived in what I would consider a horrible institution. Both of these men were drawn together to make a right out of a wrong. Both of them were compassionate people. And at that time, they created a bond, resulting in a long-standing, strong relationship. Phil Pinsky was a local attorney dedicated to healthcare, culture, and of course, family issues. He loved this community. He was president of the Board of Trustees of Loretto. He served with the Symphony, Syracuse Stage, the Jewish Community Center, the Jewish Federation, among many other affiliations. Professionally, he staffed the New York State Senate majority. He was chief counsel to the Commission on Child Welfare and welfare attorney of Onondaga County. But he was especially proud of his role with the Syracuse University College of Law, where he taught students, which just made him feel very, very good. Jim Introne also served New York State. When he applied for the executive director's position at Loretto, he had recently left the New York State OMRDD. We don't like that name anymore because it was the Office of Mental Retardation and Developmental Disabilities. The name has been changed. When Jim applied for the job at Loretto, I was chair of the board, and Jack Mannion, and I don't know if he's here today, chaired the search committee. Jim found us through a very tiny, like a quarter-inch ad in the New York Times. At his initial interview, he knocked our socks off because he announced, sitting there being interviewed, that we, the board, had no idea about our potential financial losses. And even though we said to him the guidance we had received were some very special community people, people such as Monsignor Charles Fahey, who is here with us today, Bud Costello, John Clancy, and Marty Kendrick. However, we liked Jim's directness, his honesty, and the guy had done his homework. He had looked at all our budgets. So even though he shocked us, we hired him. Jim is a wizard at identifying financial glitches, program opportunities, and ways to improve the delivery of health care. He gave our community and Loretto 20 years in which time he built a strong financial base, new facilities at all levels of care, and two of the most well-known that I think all of you will know is the Continuing Care Retirement Community at the Nottingham and the PACE program, which allows people to stay in their own home and receive services. When Jim and Valerie left Syracuse for the beautiful beaches of Florida and the historical sites in Italy, I think Jim began to feel a little lonely about wanting to return to the healthcare scene. He returned to state government and held progressively responsible and higher positions. He served three governors, Mario Cuomo, Hugh Carey, and Andrew Cuomo. He was head of the Medicaid redesign team, major reform of the New York State Medicaid program, and he was Governor Andrew Cuomo's healthcare advisor and so oversaw operations and programs in multiple departments. And between government jobs, Jim was also president and CEO of the Catholic healthcare system of the Archdiocese of New York. It was called ArchCare. Jim, do you have a problem keeping a job? We also want to welcome Valerie back to Syracuse. Valerie, it's nice to see you. She's a woman of her own special talents. I recall that Valerie was an expert sewer, and she gave her talents to the high school, Fayolmanlius. She put their costume closet together so that all their productions would have the right costumes for all the kids in the show. So, Valerie, it's nice to see you back, and I wish you could stay. Jim's here to talk to us about what's been happening from Willowbrook to DSRIP. How many people in this room know about DSRIP and can explain it? One, fabulous, two, three, four. Isn't that wonderful? I was at a meeting recently with a bunch of healthcare professionals, and I said, can anybody in the room explain DSRIP to me? And the best answer was, let me get it here, isn't that the newly discovered ancient dinosaur that I just read about? So Jim, set us straight. Is DSRIP a dinosaur?
Well, good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. You shouldn't follow Chucky Holstein, you know. She gave half my speech, so I'm going to have to wing it here for a little bit and stuff. And, you know, I wouldn't want to correct her, so I'm going to have to stick with her history of things. So it's good to be home again. Valerie and I, as Chucky mentioned, lived here for 20 years. It's the longest we've lived continuously in any one place in our lives. People ask me where I'm from, I say Syracuse, and then I have to explain Syracuse is a really nice place to live with really nice people, and forget about all that snow stuff. It's, sort of a myth. Yeah. But it is nice. It's nice to be home. And I'm really pleased that Marilyn asked me to be the speaker in the first of these lectures in honor of Phil Pinsky. He was a good friend of mine and, as Chucky mentioned, a partner. And more than that, he was a mentor. I did meet Phil about 40 years ago, probably some a little bit more now. He was the associate counsel. He worked for Senator Warren Anderson, Republican majority leader, state senate. And I had just gone to work for Hugh Carey, the newly elected Democratic governor in New York. And so as I saw it then, I recall this quite clearly, Phil represented the dark side. You know, they want to thwart progress and, you know, and all that stuff. And I was part of the Enlightenment. Oh, here, the new guys that came in and we were going to fix everything in New York. So it didn't go well, those first few meetings. But at that time, I was 30 years old, and I suffered from an ailment that I think is common to young people, but these days seems to be common to older people, too, particularly in Washington. That I believe that if I thought it was right, it was in fact right, which, you know, there was no room for any other opinion. Phil, of course, didn't quite see it that way, and thankfully he was enormously patient with me. And finally, I learned that important lesson, early lesson in my life, that if you can't admit to the possibility that you're wrong, you're never going to learn anything. So it was my first lesson, and I hope I give Phil the credit for that. Can't remember exactly how Phil and I met, but I think it was pre-Willowbrook. I think it was when we put together Chapter 853, the laws of 1976, which fundamentally changed the way in which kids with disabling conditions could gain access to educational services. It was a really good piece of legislation, and I think it stands today as the foundation for the special ed system that we have in New York. But as Chucky mentioned, Phil and I really became friends and partners as part of the team of really extraordinary folks who played an essential role in implementing the Willowbrook Consent Decree. Now, I wonder often whether it matters, as to whether the particular individuals who are in place make a difference, or whether we as individuals are just part of or instruments of some preordained progression of events. And, you know, with Willowbrook, we had such an extraordinary team. There were people there, and I know the things that we did, and I try and, you know, imagine what it would be like if we weren't there, whether the Willowbrook Consent Decree could have been implemented. I suppose so, but on the other hand, we did some interesting things that nobody else was prepared to do. For those of you who don't know about the Willowbrook story, it was actually the constitutional case was brought in 1972, Freedom from Harm case, and Governor Carey was, when he ran for election in 1974, he went to ARC, Association for the Help of Retarded Children, went to their convention and said he would sign the decree if he was elected governor. And he did sign the decree, or he signed a consent order. They immediately upon becoming governor, he had his staff negotiate the decree, which he signed in April of 1975. At the time the Willowbrook case was brought in 72, I think the institution, which is on Staten Island, was home to 7,000 individuals having intellectual developmental disabilities. And it was in many respects a horrible place. There are Syracuse connections. Some of you may know of Burton Blatt, who in 1966 co-authored Christmas in Purgatory, which was part of the expose that occurred in the late 60s, early 70s about conditions in institutions for individuals with developmental disabilities, mental illness. If you haven't looked at that, you should pick it up. It really is a very powerful piece of literature, very slim volume, but very, very powerful. So the governor signed the decree in 1975, but it sort of languished until I sort of arrived on the scene in 1976. You may recall those days. There was a lot going on with New York City. And I think what happened, I don't really remember, I think what happened was all the really talented people were preoccupied with New York City, and there was nobody left to do human services stuff. So I was sitting around there, I guess, and they picked me to do it. And from about 1976 on, Willowbrook became my little baby. And we had to put a lot of things together, created an Office of Mental Retardation, broke up the old Department of Mental Hygiene, hired my first commissioner was Tom Coughlin, and I became second commissioner, and I think Phil had probably had something to do with that. I was not getting along very well with the committee chair in the Senate at the time, and in retrospect, I don't know how I could have been confirmed if it wasn't for Phil Pinsky's fine hand reaching out and making sure that confirmation vote went okay. But over those 5 years, we had very interesting times, and ultimately, we were successful. Ultimately, we fulfilled the terms and conditions of that decree, and Willowbrook is no more, but more importantly, those conditions do not exist anywhere in New York State. I could spend some more time telling you why Willowbrook was important, not just in regard to the people who were directly affected, but also because it was a model. For me, it was certainly a model of care for how to deliver care to dependent populations, and that became my lifelong endeavor. But Willowbrook was also important because it taught lessons for anybody who looked at it. It really taught lessons about human beings' obligations to one another and those obligations that need to transcend judgments about the worthiness of individuals. And it's an important lesson when you're dealing with especially dependent and needy populations. But Marilyn told me that people don't want to just listen to old stories. They want to know about the new stuff, so I shouldn't dwell upon Willowbrook, and I should get on with it, and talk a little bit about Medicaid reform in modern times. So I'm sure most of you know Medicaid was enacted in New York State in 1966, following congressional authorization in 1965. And in keeping with Nelson Rockefeller's bent in all matters of state legislation, we adopted the most expansive Medicaid program possible in the country. But it took about a year, I think, for people to begin to wonder exactly what they'd done, because the budget began to take off on Medicaid and far exceeded all estimates. So 10 years later, after Medicaid was authorized, or not quite 10 years later, 1974, Rockefeller is gone, and we have an election, and Governor Kerry gets elected. And he declares in his first State of the State message that the days of wine and roses are over, and budgets needed to be reined in. Now, a lot of attention was paid at that time to the New York City fiscal crisis, and it did demand a lot of attention. But there was a state budget crisis at the same time, and part of that crisis was the state Medicaid expense trend. So something had to be done about Medicaid, and it was. We enacted in 1976 again, Chapter 76 of the Laws of 76, which was the first comprehensive Medicaid cost containment measure. Medicaid, when it came into being, was conceived of as sort of an entitlement program, an adjunct to the income supports that were in place through the welfare system. And it wasn't thought about too much as an instrument for managing health care. 1976, that changed. And we began to look at Medicaid not as an entitlement program, not from the perspective of the recipients, but we looked at it in terms of what it was doing to the supply side of things. And we really created a lot of structures in 1976 that are still with us today. That law expanded the health department's control over hospital and nursing homes rate setting. It tightened eligibility for Medicaid services, led to tightened regulation of the state hospitals, which in turn resulted in a significant decline in the number of hospitals. And I think, Monsignor, those were the days when you had how many, 11 hospitals, 12 hospitals here, and they were merged and got down to the four, I guess, three and one. And that happened throughout New York. Well, it was a successful effort in that it did turn the Medicaid cost curve a little bit, turned it down, and the result was that state budget developed a margin in 1977, 1978 that allowed Governor Carey to cut taxes. That's what my whole history of my life has been, cutting Medicaid for tax reductions in New York. But he did cut taxes and he won re-election. And so I'm not sure without that Medicaid cost containment effort in 76, he would have been reelected. But what Governor Carey also did during his term was to appoint a new fresh face to the health department as commissioner. That was David Axelrod. And people speak today still of David Axelrod as being the best health commissioner ever in the state of New York. David took the cost containment measures developed in the Carey years one step further in the Cuomo years, when he continued to serve as, I think I read and that at least one reporter of the New York Times, I think, called David Axelrod the most influential cabinet member in the Cuomo administration. But he set about continuing to expand the state's control over the healthcare system, and we have today probably the most regulated, at least arguably the most regulated healthcare system in the nation. But back then, people thought that was generally the right direction to go in. David unfortunately died an untimely death in 1991. I, along with Monsignor, was on the Public Health Council during this period of time, and we had our monthly or twice a month meetings with David, and did some interesting things as Public Health Council members, including the cessation of smoking in public places and the closing of the bathhouses during the AIDS epidemic in New York, which produced some interesting meetings for us. At that time, during this period, state's rate setting authority was extended to all payers, not just Medicaid payers in New York. The state continued with a very rigid certificate of need process to control the growth of the supply of services in New York. By that time, I had come to Loretto. 1986, I came to Loretto, and George Pataki became governor. It was a good time not to be in Albany for me. I shouldn't say much about the Pataki record because I'm terribly biased about it, but it was a little bit of a strange record. He came into office as a sort of conservative and talked about opening up the healthcare system to the free market and let the market run the healthcare system. He deregulated the rate setting system, but he also expanded Medicaid eligibility. And during those years, and it was 12 years of Pataki, an interesting alliance formed between Service Employees International Union, SEIU, 1199, led by Dennis Rivera, and the Greater New York Hospital Association. And there a pattern developed in Albany where the governor would every year go to the legislature and recommend cuts in Medicaid, and every year buses of people would come up from New York City, sponsored by 1199 and the unions, and the Medicaid cuts would be overturned, and the workers were happy, and the hospitals were happy, and the budget was left to be balanced in some other day. But the result of that over a 12-year period was a tremendous growth in Medicaid, almost double-digit on average, probably 8 or 9% growth over that 12-year period. I think the statistic is when we got there in 76, Medicaid was something like 10% of the state budget. When I got back there in 2011, Medicaid was 40% of the state budget. So it was really just crowding out everything else. And at the end of the Pataki administration, there was something called the Berger Commission that they put together. Some of you may remember the Berger Commission. Steve Berger's an old friend of mine, was part of the Kerry administration as well, and he's the guy who really did it. Chucky, the Board of Social Welfare, wasn't me. And Steve's a great guy, and he's super smart, but the Berger Commission, which was the gateway to the expenditure of some waiver monies at that time called the HEAL grants. Spent a lot of money, but I'm not sure we did a lot to change the nature of Medicaid. Closed a few hospitals. Didn't close anything here in Syracuse, I don't think, as a result of the Berger Commission. And, you know, it really didn't slow down much the growth of Medicaid. What finally slowed down the growth of Medicaid was the recession in 2000, 2008, 2009, and there was a small downturn during that period. But otherwise, it was continuing to progress. Of course, 2007, I left Loretto, went to New York City to work for the Archdiocese. Elliot Spitzer, moved into the governor's office. I had a better time in New York than Elliot Spitzer did. I started another PACE program, started a Medicare managed care program. He got caught in a place he shouldn't have been. And in the middle of the country's worst economic downturn, David Paterson took over as governor, and that did not go well. So not much was accomplished during that that term. So that brings us now finally to Andrew. I've known Andrew Cuomo for a very long time. I knew his father, knew him. And it was pretty reasonable that I would get involved in his campaign in some way. And it was also pretty reasonable. Andrew is a very talented guy and very energetic and very smart. He knows a lot of things about a lot of things, but he doesn't really know healthcare all that well. So it was pretty reasonable that I not only became part of his transition team, but that he would ask me to be his deputy secretary for health when we took office in 2011. Actually, Andrew's closest advisor is a close friend of mine by the name of Jeff Sachs. He was also a Kerry guy. And Jeff was really the head of the small group that was advising the incoming governor on healthcare issues. And at that time, Jeff, in December of 2010, became enamored of something called a stakeholder engagement effort. And it was getting to be a popular way of approaching public policy issues. And Jeff had identified a guy in Wisconsin by the name of Jason Helgerson, who was the Medicaid director out there. And he had done a stakeholder engagement effort. And Jeffrey said, well, why don't we see if we get this guy into New York, and we'll do something like that. So we did, recruited a fellow from Wisconsin. Fortunately, there was an election, and I can't remember the name of that Wisconsin governor they got out there, who doesn't like to spend money on health care, education, or anything else. So Jason came to New York, and we were joined by Nirav Shah, who was a very bright new health commissioner. And that was our sort of transition team in December of 2010, sort of paving the way for the new governor's healthcare policy. And then the new governor surprised me in the State of the State message in January 2011. He announced that Jason and I were there and we were going to solve the Medicaid problem. So I don't know if you remember what that election year was like in 2010. But I remember pretty clearly that Medicaid was the number one election year issue. There wasn't a county executive in the state that wasn't claiming that Medicaid was overwhelming their budgets. It was consuming all the sales tax, it was consuming all the property tax. If we didn't get Medicaid off their backs, there was not going to be any money left for anything in county government. It was a huge issue. And Richard Ravitch, who everybody thinks is a really smart guy, became lieutenant governor, and he did this study, is the most important thing he did as lieutenant governor, I guess, was this study about where New York is going, and he said in this study that Medicaid is the single biggest issue in New York, and if we didn't solve the Medicaid problem, everything was going to be consumed in the Medicaid, by the Medicaid budget. So, and the of course, the governor's opponent was also beating the drums about something had to be done about Medicaid. And most of the solutions, the proposed solutions at the time were, we're going to cut benefits, we're going to cut eligibility, we're going to eliminate some of the options that Rockefeller put in there. It all were ways of shrinking the Medicaid Medicaid benefit. So we had, though, a little bit of a different idea. The governor was a Democrat and was elected with a pretty progressive, I guess, platform. And he was not particularly enthralled by the notion of eligibility reductions or service reductions. So Jason and I got called in. Governor announced in January 1st that Jason and I were going to do something about Medicaid. January 5th, I think, he issued executive order number 5 that set up the Medicaid redesign team. And during that period of time, Jason and I spent some time with the governor. And we were pretty clear about our instructions. We had 90 days to fix this problem. So I don't know what would have happened if we hadn't been successful. I mean, a lot of proposals had been generated. None of them had worked. But if our effort didn't work, there didn't seem to be any way out, any way to balance that budget. So we felt we had no alternative but to be successful. Well, the Medicaid redesign team turned out to be a great idea. There were 25 members on it, myself, Jeff Sachs, Nirav Shah, and also Ken Raske from Greater New York, George Gresham from 1199, and a lot of other peoples that had really important stakes in the Medicaid budget in New York. Jason was the staff director. In the weeks that followed, Jason was 40 years old, though. I was much older. But in the weeks that followed, Jason and I spent many, many hours together. Even as we tried to do our other jobs, because we did have other jobs, there are other things going on in healthcare and other things going on in Medicaid that had to be attended to. But when we weren't doing those, Jason and I traveled the state to listen to people all over the state. We had, I think, something like 5 hearings in which MRT, the team members attended. And my office in Albany had an open door, and from the the time we opened to the time we closed those doors, we had troops of people coming in to talk about what we wish to do about Medicaid. Jason put up a website. We had over a couple of thousand ideas generated by that website. And at the end of about 60 days, we went through a process of taking everything we had heard and putting it together again. We came up after that 2-month period with 79 recommendations for legislative change and a bunch for administrative change that didn't need legislation. Put those before the legislature, 78 of them were adopted. We produced $2.2 billion worth of savings in the 2011-2012 state budget. And we introduced a Medicaid spending cap to ensure that Medicaid would not grow beyond 4% a year. It was tied to an index that at that time was about 3.9%. It's since gone down. And in fact, Medicaid, if you look at the Medicaid cost curve, it took a dramatic turn in 2011-12 and has continued that way. Today, Medicaid expenses per enrollee are less than they were in 2003. So it was a really very dramatic set of policy changes that were tremendously successful. And I think if you think about the election we just had, 2014 or so, Medicaid was not an issue. I don't think it ever got raised during the campaign. So we went from 2010, when it was the number one issue, to 2014, when it was no issue at all. Now, you know, to keep it going requires still additional efforts. The cap on Medicaid expenditure growth challenges providers to implement strategies to reduce unnecessary utilization and transition services from institutional to community settings. But recognizing that these changes would include transitional costs, we committed during the period of the MRT that we would pursue a federal waiver, Medicaid waiver, to develop the investment capital necessary to assist the providers throughout the state to undertake the transitions and become more efficient providers and more effective providers of care. And we had some difficulties with that waiver. There were some side things going on, and CMS was a little bit unhappy with the way monies were being spent in OMRDD. So they had some issues that needed to be attended to before they would approve the waiver. But in early 2014, CMS approved the waiver that has become known as DSRIP, Delivery System Reform Incentive Payment System. And under the DSRIP program, essentially, there's some 26 coalitions of healthcare providers around the state, 25 maybe, that have come together and with a commitment to reform their delivery systems, to pursue population health strategies, to improve outcomes for people, decrease utilization, move services from the institutional side to the community side. And these efforts are going to be carefully measured. Outcomes are going to be looked at, and to the extent that the measures that the implementation efforts are successful, these provider networks will receive at least up to $7 billion of the waiver monies and additional state investments. Probably more than $7 billion. Of the waiver monies and additional state investments in capital. So there's a long way to go, but it's been a 1966, the history of Medicaid, 50-year history in this program. It took a long, long time to get to a place where it's, I think, finally under control, where Medicaid is not going to be synonymous in New York State with excess and dysfunction, but will become and can become truly a comprehensive healthcare system for people with limited income. There are 6 million people in New York that get their health care because of Medicaid. By and large, their outcomes are every bit as good as the outcomes of healthcare outcomes for the population that is not on Medicaid. There are significant issues of healthcare disparities, but overall, Medicaid system does a wonderful job in New York of improving the health of New Yorkers. So I've been proud to be associated with it for this entire history. I'm very proud that we've gotten it in a good place now, and I'm very hopeful that that's going to continue. DSRIP will be successful. We hear a lot today about government that doesn't work, and certainly we saw problems, and I've seen problems over my 40 years with government where things didn't work out all that well. But in both Willowbrook, in the case of Willowbrook, in the case of Medicaid, I think we have illustrations of where government can work, can do good things. If good people are assigned to the job, work hard, we can produce good outcomes. So I'm very proud of it. I'm pleased to be here at this time with you and happy to talk about. I have stories to tell if you ask probing questions. I can tell stories about Chucky. Anything else, but I'd be happy to talk to you a little bit more about it if you have some questions.
Thank you, Jim. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and as I spot the questions, I'll get to you.
The pendulum swings. 40 years ago, there began a movement for the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill. Today, our newspapers are filled after a mass shooting about the mentally ill. Locally, stories when local men and women are panhandling. The wintertime, especially, stories about men and women on the streets of Syracuse living under bridges. Much of this goes back and refers to the mentally ill. So I'm just hoping that you might just talk about your thoughts on that issue.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that. Back in the days, we had a Department of Mental Hygiene, right? And my primary concern, we had a court case on the side of MR and DD. And we, if we didn't fulfill the terms of the decree, we were going to be sanctioned by the federal government. The federal government would have taken over the system. So we were really very focused on that. But one of the things we concluded was we weren't going to solve that problem unless we had a separate department for MR, DD. Then we also created the separate department for mental health and recruited Jim Prevost from Syracuse to come and run that department. But we never had the kind of organized energy on the MH side that we did on the MR side to fix the problem in the delivery system, mental health delivery system. So when I left state government in 1981, that was one of my great regrets, that was unfinished business. And I didn't work in that area. I was mostly geriatric services or MRDD. And I was very pleased when I went back in 2010, I was gonna have another shot at that. And what we did, and MRT had a very important sub-effort on the mental health side. And what we did is we got the associations, we got the advocacy groups on the mental health side to buy in to the movement of the mental health population into managed care. Pataki put the general Medicaid population into Medicaid managed care programs back in the 90s. But that part of the program, that part of the Medicaid population that was chronic, had chronic conditions, the DD population, the geriatric population, the mental health population, behavioral needs population, was out of managed care. When we did MRT, we made an agreement with the advocacy groups and to move them in. And that effort is pretty much, I think it was October 1 this year. The MH populations are being rolled into managed care, and the severely mentally ill have choices of joining what's called HARPS. I can't remember, health and rehabilitation, something or other. HARPS, which are a set of specialty services for the MH, severely mentally ill population, and also gives them access to non-Medicaid community services. So long story short, over the next few years, any individual on Medicaid with a diagnosis of mental illness will have a care manager. That's never happened before, never happened. Now, you're still going to have compliance programs, but if there is a problem with somebody who has a diagnosis of mental illness, there is going to be a care manager that's responsible for whatever that problem is. And I am hopeful that the attachment of the mental health caseload to a managed care system and to care management is going to produce much better outcomes for that population. So, a little known part of MRT, which is very, very important.
Good morning. I have maybe a two-pronged question, but basically, I'm looking at the effect of unfunded mandates that the county execs you talked about were all going crazy about, and we talk about at these meetings sometimes. Understanding the state did put a cap eventually on how much the counties would have to pay into this program. Wondering what impact that had on all of this. And the second thing really is just Affordable Care Act. What, if any, impact that's had on this as well?
Yeah, I mean, the county budgets are going to be relieved of Medicaid, right? I mean, there's no more growth on the county side for Medicaid. And eventually that the local share will be picked up. So it's solved. Medicaid is not a county problem anymore. The whole state-local scheme that Rockefeller put in place, the 50-50 sharing of the non-federal share, is gone, right? So interestingly enough, the county mandates let me digress just a moment. I think executive order number 5 was MRT. I think number four was SAGE. Number 6 maybe was the Mandate Relief Commission. We used the stakeholder engagement process. They did not. We were successful. They were not. So there is that. We did a lot of stuff in Medicaid, but that process that we use, that stakeholder engagement process, I was really enamored of that as a way to approach knotty public policy issues. And I wish I could convince people to use it more, because I think it really works. When we went to the legislature with 79 recommendations, they really had little choice but to pass those, because we had developed a consensus among all the stakeholders. If they didn't approve those, they were running counter to an apparent consensus that we had developed. I think it's a very logical way to approach public policy issues that have long-standing entrenched interests and a way to overcome them. But anyway, I'm digressing. So, Affordable Care Act, I think it's unfortunate that it came out the way it did. I think it was 1991. I was at Loretto, but I was interested in assisted living, right? Because assisted living was coming in for private pay people, and I'm saying, why don't we have assisted living for Medicaid people? So I went to Albany, and I worked with some people, and we put together, and Phil was part of that too, put together an assisted living piece of legislation. And it turned out to be a terrible program. It was awful. Medicaid assisted living is an awful program. But I was working with one of my younger colleagues who was working with the Senate Associations, and I said to her, long way, I said, you know, this program is never going to work. It's no good. And she said, Jim, you don't understand. It's the only one that will pass. Boy, I learned something then. I felt really, she was, it's the only program that will pass. And I think that's the same thing with the Affordable Care Act. I think it is. I don't want to say it's not workable, but I think it could work much better. We could have had more coverage. We could have, you know, avoided some of the problems that occurred with the rollout if we had had a different piece of legislation. But we had the only piece of legislation that would pass, and, you know, with all its flaws. I'm glad we have it, right? We've got still millions of people covered now that weren't covered, and it makes no sense to deliver health care through hospital emergency rooms to people who can't afford access to care.
Hello. The 79th MRT recommendation was about tort reform, and malpractice is one of the last remaining issues in New York State. Could you comment on that?
It almost derailed the entire MRT effort, MedMal. We felt sort of honor-bound to include a MedMal proposal. We owed it to everybody. That was part of the MRT effort. But the MedMal interests in the legislature are so entrenched, particularly, you know, I don't have anything to lose, right? Particularly with Shelley, you know, I mean, there was no MedMal was going to pass the assembly as long as Shelley was speaker. So we put up that proposal, and I knew we were going to catch a lot of flack, and we did. And you know, some not so nice things occurred because we put up that proposal. And ultimately, we knew we were going to have to give up on it, so we did. I don't know where, you know, until the characters of the state legislature changes, whether we're going to get meaningful MedMal reform in New York.
First, I want to thank you for mentioning Burton Blatt. He was an absolute giant in the movement to close all the institutions.
Is that you, Michael?
No, it's Bob Goodfellow.
Oh, Bob, okay.
Center on Human Policy. So it shows. Huh? But one part of that movement was recognizing that people with developmental disabilities, the vast majority of their services have nothing to do with medical services. Yet we ride the Medicaid money. And it presents quite a dilemma in that we burden the system for people as services for people with developmental disabilities with the same issues that relate to the medical system. Would you care to address that?
I'm glad you mentioned that, too. I saw Paula Freeman coming in and mentioned her. I was going to mention the name of Bob Norris. I talked about the team that we put together in Albany, and one of the team members was a fellow by the name of Bob Norris, who was SU grad. And he was the one that figured out we could get Medicaid to pay for deinstitutionalization. And then I had to, and then my job was to go sell that to the advocacy groups, which was really hard because they were concerned about exactly what you're talking about. We introduced, because it was Medicaid, rigidities into the service model that probably wouldn't have been there if we were able to fund it otherwise. But, you know, it was a Hobbesian choice. We didn't have the money. The only way we could get the money into the system to fund deinstitutionalization was to tap into the Medicaid stream. So we did. Now, Medicaid has become more flexible over time. Back then, there weren't waiver programs. Now you can construct waiver programs. CMS is still a very difficult bureaucracy to negotiate. But I think if you pursue intelligent waiver programs, and OPWDD, we've gotten over the funding crisis that we had there, and we're paying back the feds what they said were overcharges. With that behind us, I think the conditions are right for another waiver. I regretted that we didn't get an OPWDD waiver through by the time I left, but hopefully there will be a waiver to create a service system. I personally think we need to break the residential model and get into a person-centered model, and I think managed care would do that for us. Can be done, but it's going to need an intelligently designed waiver program to do that.
Jim, the very first question that was asked was about mental health, and you spoke to it. But there's a part of it that you didn't speak to, and that is the people that are in the correction system. There have been tens of thousands of people with mental health that have ended up in jail and prisons, and they're there. How and what is going to be done by New York State to see that that is corrected, that they be not be sent to prison, but rather have care?
There are some interesting things going on. I don't know the details. I mean, part of the MRT effort was the result, one of the recommendations was creating health homes, which were constructed for the purpose of managing care to the general Medicaid population as opposed to the chronically impaired, which went into different forms of managed care. In New York City, they've got at least one health home that has been constructed for that population that is revolving through through Rikers. So there is a group, there's an active group in the health department that is trying to develop the mechanisms to bring Medicaid into play so that there can be diversion from jail for individuals with a mental health diagnosis, and so they can pick up on discharges from Rikers earlier. I think they're doing Medicaid eligibility determination now in the prisons, so people are coming out with their benefits. So I'm not an expert on it. I know there are efforts underway. It's recognized as a significant problem.
Jim, I'm glad you mentioned patient-centered care, because I think that's the movement today where the patient is going to be able to tell us what they want for their care and not be top-down. So in Syracuse, not in Syracuse, in Onondaga County, we recently completed a study on how to make Central New York age-friendly. We know that almost a third of the Onondaga County population is over 65. It's only going to grow because you baby boomers are going to make that population number go way up. Is there anything in any one of the programs that you talked about could help a community become more age-friendly, not only with health care, but with the other benefits as well?
I didn't talk about, I'm not sure I know that much about it, sort of the infrastructure for healthcare reform, but there is an infrastructure that is basically data management or information management. When we did Willowbrook, we didn't have the ability to communicate the abilities that we have today to communicate digitally. And that's why I think we developed residential models, and the PACE program was a very personal model, right? Now, and what's making a difference, why some of the reform things we've done in recent years are being done now, they couldn't have been done 30 years ago, because we didn't have the ability to move information. I think that's what's going to make the difference. When we can move information about people to the right places at the right time, we're going to infinitely improve our capacity to manage people in their communities, manage people at home, to spot problems when they develop, to get people the transportation they need, get them the groceries they need, the drugs they need, the services they need. It all depends upon our ability to communicate instantly and very effectively. And those structures are coming up. The New York State has sponsored those. We've got a statewide, the SHINee, being rolled out around the state. But there's a very robust, vibrant digital startup sector that's developing in New York City with some very, very interesting new developments about how to improve the delivery of healthcare and other services. with the availability of better information. And Valerie's got my, I got a little bit of a heart problem. So my primary care doc said I ought to get one of these apps for my iPhone. Valerie's got my iPhone, I'd show it to you. It's, I've got an app called AliveCore, which gives me an instant ECG if I feel that I need to do it, which I can send to my doctor immediately. It's instant stuff. Yeah, you're going to see that all over the port.
I want to thank you, Jim and Trona. I also want to thank Marilyn Pinsky and her family for sharing the lecture with us.